Hey, we're back. We're back here in Building 92 at the Visitor Center at Build. We've got the man who pays the bills himself, Scott Gu. How's it going, sir?
Good, thanks.
Very, very cool. And I'm enjoying a lovely non-specific brand, non-specific soda here that I've enjoyed. It's been diet soda. I've been having it all day. Thank you for the free soda, sir.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So, lovely keynote. Thank you for letting me be involved in a tiny way.
It was fun. It was fun. It's even more fun than it's over, but it's...
Yeah, it was fun.
It was fun doing it.
A lot of work goes into that to make things really, really smooth. What did we announce today?
Oh, we announced a bunch of things. On the Azure front, we got a number of nice announcements and a number of nice releases this week. Brand new portal update of the new Azure Management Portal is released. Lots of new features with media services, with mobile, with Windows Phone 8 support for building mobile Azure mobile services. Our websites now you can deploy all over the world. So they're available in regions in Asia, Europe, and the U.S. The release of the .NET of Azure SDK 1.8, which includes both Windows Server 2012 and .NET 4.5 support. .NET 4.5 support for Azure websites. A dedicated cache release for final release. We added AMQP support to Service Bus and a whole bunch more.
Wow,
so,
okay.
Lots of cool stuff.
So let's break some of these down. So starting, we've got .NET 4.5.
Yep.
I can do that now on websites, and I can do that in
cloud services.
In cloud services,
yep.
As well.
And you can also do it inside virtual machines if you're as well.
Okay, because you control the virtual machine, you do whatever you want.
So you can take advantage of all those great capabilities with async that you know are kind of built in as part of .NET 4.5. In Scott's part of the keynote this morning, we also showed off some of the great work that we're doing in the Entity Framework 6, which now supports async with link queries. We showed off some of the great new features in the ASP.NET fall preview that we're releasing today as well, mm-hmm. Including Facebook app support, as well as all those cool things that you showed. OData support with web APIs.
Yeah.
A bunch of other cool things. Definitely check out his demo. And then I showed off some of the SignalR stuff that we're also adding as part of the ASP.NET fall preview in my portion of the keynote.
Actually, little side note then, SignalR, that's like a real thing now.
Yeah, so SignalR is now going to be officially part of ASP.NET.
Uh-huh.
It's an open source project, so it also is available separately. But we're also, one of the things we announced today is we're actually adding it into all the standard ASP.NET projects going forward. And the cool thing about SignalR is it lights up and takes full advantage of WebSockets where they're available. And so you can now use them inside cloud services, inside Windows Azure, use that to scale really well. So it's a nice update today.
So I could take a .NET 4.5 website, put it in any region now. It used to be just West US, but now anywhere in the world.
Well, actually, we used to support multiple regions around the world, mm-hmm. In Europe and in North America. We didn't support Asia until this week. But what we did was... in the first preview, basically, once you picked a region the first time you deployed, you could only deploy to that region in the future. And it was kind of a temporary limitation.
Down.
Yeah. So one of the things we did as part of this release is now you can create 6 websites and you can run them in 6 different regions. You can create more than that. But you can run in Asia, you can run 2 regions in the US and 2 regions in Europe.
So could I even run my whole system such that when someone comes in and I know that they're from Europe, I could run them out of Europe and they would get a faster experience than someone in California?
Yeah, you can. So that's one of the features that we do support, which is this general idea we call traffic management. And so you can either use our traffic manager or you can use a third-party traffic manager, and there's multiple companies that do it. And then when you do that, basically when the DNS resolves for an end user, mm-hmm. you can resolve it to an endpoint that's local to that region. So someone in Europe would go to a Europe version, someone in Asia would go to the Asia version. And generally one of the things that's kind of a truism in cloud computing is you can never go faster than the speed of light.
Yeah.
So in general, each 100 miles that you transfer bits over of cabling, it's about 1 millisecond of latency that gets added. If you want to reach a worldwide audience, doing kind of geo-distributed versions of your app is the mm-hmm. best way to get the best experience for everyone.
So I take my 4.5 app, I can put it in websites, I can put SignalR in that, and it'll get WebSockets now.
With websites right now, you can put SignalR on it, mm-hmm. and you can definitely take advantage of async.
Right.
Websites still doesn't use Windows Server 2012 yet.
Okay.
That's going to be an update we're going to be doing hopefully shortly.
Cool.
And once you do that, then you'll have full WebSockets.
And it'll just light up one day.
Yeah.
And this is one of the things I thought was really interesting, because I spoke with Josh Twist earlier, and he was telling me that he built mobile services on top of websites.
Yeah.
And websites, of course, built on top of Windows Server.
Yeah.
So that will just light up one day. Like, I'm not going to have to go and check a box to say I really like WebSockets.
Yeah.
One day, my website will have this feature.
You'll just get it for free, yeah. And the nice thing with SignalR is it'll light up. And so once it's available, it'll just start using it.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to change any code. But yeah, it's kind of the overall kind of composability story for Azure. You know, wherever possible, we try to reuse our infrastructure. And so, you know, mobile services actually runs on top of the same kind of runtime that we use to host websites,
mm-hmm.
Our website feature. And our website feature is actually built on top of our cloud services feature. And then under the covers, each VM uses Windows Server. So it actually allows us to kind of maximize code reuse.
Yeah.
It means that when we light up a feature in one area, we can surface it throughout the stack.
I actually, you know, I'm on your team and didn't realize it was that organized. That's pretty awesome. I didn't actually realize that web services were built on top of the cloud services.
Yeah.
That's really cool. And speaking of new services, you did this media services thing.
Yep.
Because I uploaded a video in my part, and I just saved it in blob storage. And now I did use async and await, and I felt I was very special when I did that.
Yeah.
But then you went and kind of blew my demo out of the water by then making it much bigger, and you used media services.
Yeah. So media services is one of the kind of building block application features that we're going to be shipping the first release of it this fall, so this calendar year. And it basically gives you a way that you can ingest, encode, and stream video. And so, you know, my guess is next year's build conference will probably Channel 9 will be streaming through it. And so we'll support video on demand today, and then we're enabling live streaming as a part of a future update. And the beauty is you can stream any format. So you can actually upload a video and say, you know, MPEG-4 based video, and you could transcode it or convert it to any format. So you could do smooth streaming and go to Silverlight. You could do Flash with RTMP. You could do HLS with iOS. You could do smooth streaming with Windows 8. And it's just a platform as a service kind of feature. So you're not deploying a VM. You basically just go in the portal, create a media service, and then you just send REST calls to it, and away it goes.
And then the files, if I take let's say I take a gigabyte file, big, giant, high-def file, and I want it to work anywhere on any device, I kind of ingest it, was the word, into the system, and then you take that, and then now you're going to give me notifications that this is happening. Are you going to take the result and put it into storage?
Yeah, one of the things we support is the ability, I mean, you don't have to put it in our storage system. But most commonly what people do if they're doing lots of encoding is they'll upload, you know, massive amounts into storage and then just use media services to basically encode it and then save it back into storage, the new versions. Because our storage system can support, you know, petabytes of storage within your account, you know, provides actually a really effective way that you can kind of massively work on lots and lots of data. So it just works.
So forgive my ignorance, and I know that this will probably would not get me the interview if I was coming into Microsoft for the first time, but petabyte just seems stupid large. I mean, is that like 1,000 terabytes?
Yeah, petabyte is 1,000 terabytes.
I'm trying to put in my mind, like I just went to Office Depot and I bought a terabyte drive.
Yeah.
So I mentally get the idea of how big that is.
Yeah.
One petabyte would be 1,000 of these little drives. Okay, that's crazy.
I mean, the thing that's kind of interesting about petabytes and storing that much data. I mean, you can certainly go to Office Depot and buy 1,000 of those machines, you know, 1,000 of them. Where it gets more complicated is, you know, as you add more disks, you know, you will have some degree of failure. And so you don't really want to just buy 1,000 terabyte drives and plug them in.
Mm-hmm.
You really need to have some degree of redundancy so that, you know, if you assume that one or two of those drives dies, you don't lose your data.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that our storage system kind of provides is kind of this virtualized abstraction where it looks like it's just a single, you know, storage account that you can store files into, but we're actually distributing it across many, many drives, across many, many servers.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll even actually have each of the servers be on separate racks inside the cluster on separate power supplies with separate top of rack switches.
Mm-hmm.
And the benefit there is even if we lose a network router, a machine, or a disk,
mm-hmm.
your storage isn't lost. And you know, our whole sort of system is designed both from a reliability perspective. It also uses an SSD cache on top, so that if you read and write to certain locations really hot, in a really fast way, we can give you kind of a very fast, consistent throughput.
So Azure, that kind of the Azure operating system, in quotes, kind of knows about this, and it says it knows not to put three copies of your files on the same disk, on the same power supply. This is the magic of what Azure does.
That's kind of the magic of what we do. And you know, it's similar if you think about the evolution of an operating system, you know, from DOS to Windows and Unix and so forth. You know, increasingly the operating system is abstracting out what's really happening under the covers, you know, memory address space and disk devices and things like that. You know, in some ways you can think of a cloud operating system, which is kind of what we're increasingly talking about, is kind of abstracting out not just the hardware, but it's actually multiple physical machines and racks and clusters and abstracting it in kind of a common way. Yeah. And, you know, doing that basically gives you a lot more reliability, it gives you better performance, and it gives you this kind of sense of elasticity where you can just keep adding resources and go.
I in my talk on Thursday morning, that I hope everyone comes to, I talk about this idea that there's this famous quote that no one thinks the guy really said many years ago, that there is a market in the world for maybe five computers.
Right, yeah.
And now that's happened, and there are these cloud computers. I mean, I think of Azure or a cloud operating system as this infinite resource. I mean, I don't think about firing up a VM anymore. Like, I was like, all right, I fire this VM up, it's going to cost me $3, you know, if I use it for a couple of hours or whatever. And then I just delete it, and I'm not kind of like realizing that was like the 60 gigs just moved from somewhere to somewhere, and all these elves were doing this work in the background.
Yep.
You do this part of your demo where you slide the slider up to like, what, 180, 179 VMs?
Yeah. 300, I think, today.
Yeah, 300.
Yeah.
When I do that, does that immediately just charge me, or how do I manage the billing and things like that? Do I get warned when I'm about to do something that will cost me money in Azure? If I switch from free to shared, are you going to just suddenly am I going to be poor suddenly, or do you warn me this is going to cost?
Well, one of the things we do with our free trial is we actually have what's called a spending limit. So we provide, as part of the 90-day free trial that you sign up for, a bunch of resources. So it's basically, I think it's like 750 hours of a single core, which is enough to run a VM 24/7 for 3 months. We give you a bunch of storage and databases and mobile services and websites and a bunch of stuff. And one of the things we do is we do have what's called a spending limit. So we guarantee we never bill you as part of the free trial. Hmm. And so if we hit the limit of what, you know, the number of hours you're allowed in a month, we'll actually deactivate your VM. Hmm. And well, we send you an email before, and then we deactivate the VM. And then you can go in, you can turn it back on, but we want to make sure that we never inadvertently bill you. You know, that's kind of one of the things that we provide.
Right.
And then also in the portal, you can click on your avatar in the top right, and you can say view bill, and you can always see exactly what resources you're consuming. Mm-hmm. And so we also kind of allow you to see, sort of, it gets updated about 6 or 7 times a day, so you can see exactly what you're spending resources on. You know, the nice thing about the cloud model is you do pay only for what you use.
Right.
And so, you know, if you spin up a VM for an hour and then turn it off, you know, a small VM today with our previews is like 1.2 cents is what it would cost you, I think. Or
wow.
Maybe that's an
cool.
Extra small. I think a small VM will actually use 8 cents.
Still pretty cheap.
But it's still pretty cheap.
Yeah.
You know, it's less than your nondescript drink that you can't guess what the brand is.
That's true.
So it is kind of cheap. You know, at the same time, you do want to be aware of what you're using resources. You'll see us probably in the future make it even more obvious when you go to do something, where we'll say, hey, this is going to charge you. Are you sure you want to do it? And so we are trying to, you know, make sure we have a good balance of warning people if they're going to do something that's going to cost a lot.
So let's get to the Ask Scott Goo part of the show. We've got a lot of questions, and I want to encourage the people that are on the website at ch9.ms to not just participate by putting your questions up that we're going to go through right now, but also to tweet that URL and let people know that we're live and we're up there right now, so they can check that out, ch9.ms. Number of questions coming in here. So Windows Azure Halo 4, what's this about? Halo 4 is on Azure now?
Yeah, it's one of the cool things we talked about a little bit in the keynote. There's, you know, a bunch of services inside Microsoft that are now built on Azure, you know, and you know, eventually we think everything will be. Halo is one of them that we just talked about for the first time as part of the keynote.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're planning on like 2 million concurrent users playing Halo 4 when it comes out.
Wow.
So they're built on
no Azure. Pressure for you, eh?
Yeah, no
Will
pressure.
Will you be up that night playing
yes.
Halo as well?
I have to confess, I'm not a very good. When I said when it comes out, I was like, I don't think it's come out yet. But
exactly. I can tell you're deeply following the Halo 4 story.
Yeah. I love Halo. I just don't play it. But I'm very excited they're built on Azure.
I know that while I'm playing Halo, by the way, I will be calling in sick that day to play Halo. I know that you're going to be watching the Azure CPU and seeing the success that we're having. A question here from Srinivas, who's asking about what the recommended way to back up and restore databases are.
Yeah. So one of the things you can do with SQL, so specifically with SQL Azure, and it's a very good question. I mean, I think one thing that worth mentioning is, we do copy your database onto three separate servers when it's running inside SQL Azure. So there is some redundancy in case of a hardware failure,
mm-hmm.
but we definitely recommend that you still back up your database in the event of like a data center being wiped out due to, like, say, a hurricane.
Those never happen, though.
Those never happen, yeah. You do want to make sure that you back it up.
And you back it up locally?
You can back it up a variety of different ways. Going forward, you'll see us provide kind of built-in redundancy support,
mm-hmm.
so you can automatically back it up to another data center. But today, you actually would want to do it manually. Basically, the kind of the best practice that you can do is there's a feature in Windows Azure that lets you do a transacted copy of your database.
Mm-hmm.
So generally what I'd recommend is do a transacted copy of your database to another database inside SQL Azure.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can spin one up quickly, do a transacted copy. That makes sure that you have a transactionally consistent snapshot of all your data.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's an export command where you can go ahead and export that database that you just copied to blob storage. And that provides a way that you can go ahead and back up your database with zero downtime. And once it's in blob storage, then we'll geo-replicate it to another data center that's at least 500 miles away. Or if you want, you can just download it locally. And we use the same backpack technology that SQL Server 2012 supports on-premise.
Oh, okay.
And so you can also use that technique to basically export your SQL Azure database locally and spin it up.
Rock on. Very cool. Great question from Kelly Summers, Kellabyte, on Twitter.
Yeah.
She's asking about AMQP and Service Bus. This might be a little obscure, but what does that mean to a developer? Explain this this announcement, because some of us are going to be like, yeah, rock on, AMQP, woohoo!
Yes.
Others may be like, I have no idea what that means or if it's good for me.
Kelly has a very good blog post on AMQP. It's worth checking out. For people that don't know, which is probably most people watching this, AMQP is an open protocol, and it was actually just ratified today by the OASIS Standards Group. It basically provides a messaging format. A common way to do kind of message passing and brokering. A lot of kind of message-oriented systems are going to support it. And one of the things that we did today is we basically announced support for, actually I think technically we're doing it on Friday, but I guess we're doing it right now, announcing support for AMQP.
Oops.
I think I did it earlier today.
Yeah, let's hope so.
But basically adding AMQP support to Service Bus. The benefit there is that means that you can connect to the Service Bus using any AMQP compliant client,
mm-hmm.
And basically send messages to and fro. And so there's going to be a good talk, I think, on Friday, where we'll go into a little bit more details and some cool demos of that. But it basically means that, like, you could connect with a Java system with J2ME or JMS in terms of J2EE,
right.
Where you could basically write a Java client that goes directly against Service Bus and send a message. You could then take that message in a PHP client using the Apache client library, transform it, and then have a .NET client go ahead and pull it out and respond. And so it enables a lot of interoperability. And a cool thing, I think, for people using Windows Azure is the fact that I can now just stand up a Service Bus queue or a topic or anything like that, and then just point whatever messaging client I want against it.
Mm-hmm.
And that ability to have, a kind of a guaranteed SLA messaging system that supports the ability to just send and retrieve those things, ends up being really powerful. And, it goes towards our overall interoperability story we're trying to do with Windows Azure. One of the other things that we shipped today, so the AMQP support's in preview. You don't need to turn it on. Every Service Bus queue just gets it for free. So you can start using that literally today. The other thing that we shipped today that's actually in released form is our dedicated cache as part of our SDK 1.8 release with Windows Azure. Mm-hmm. That's another example of interoperability where it supports the Memcached wire protocol. And so again, you can create our cache, you could use our .NET API against it, mm-hmm. but if you've got some open source library that talks Memcached, you can point it at our cache and it just works. And from a dev perspective, I think the big win there is it basically just lets you use whatever software you want and take advantage of our features and our management support.
It's a really nice balance between, I've talked to a number of developers that say, well, this is all great, but I want VMs. I'm like, fine, mm-hmm. we'll have VMs. And you want to run Redis or run Memcached, do it. Manage all that yourself. Mm-hmm. That's fine. Run it in VMs. Knock yourself out.
Yep.
But then you could run whole systems and never touch a virtual machine.
Yep.
And never think about any of these things. And you've got memory cache, and you've got service bus, and you've got websites, and you've got mobile services.
Yep.
And there's not a VM to be seen. There's not an operating system to run Windows Update on.
Yep.
It's just done.
Just done. I mean, that's kind of, we have this kind of model with Azure we call, focus on your app, not the infrastructure. And, part of the goal there is, as we get more managed services, as we get richer at managed services, that you as a developer can just go ahead and say, I want to sign up and use this and start using it.
Yeah.
And, two demos I showed today that, I think the audience liked in my Azure overview talks, in my breakout talk, was, I asked the poll the room, how often have you asked your IT department for a database? And how long does it take? And you get nervous twitters and laughs in the audience. Is it 20 minutes? Is it 20 hours? Is it 20 days? Is it 20 months? And
in some places, there's a fax machine involved to request a virtual machine.
I just go in the Azure portal, and I think it took 7 seconds, fully provision a new SQL database to use. And the cool thing about the pay-as-you-go model is, it cost me $5 for a month of usage. I don't have to buy a license. I don't have to buy anything. I can just start using it. And I think that's kind of an aha for developers and for dev shops where it's like, wow. I can start using that. And then the other demo I showed that's in my breakout talk at the end is how you could use the new Windows Azure Store that we're also announcing today, which allows you to subscribe not just to Microsoft services but to third-party services. And so in my breakout talk, I showed how you could subscribe to Mongo Labs, which is a third-party partner of ours that provides MongoDB hosting on Azure.
Mm-hmm.
And the beauty is, I could basically create a new MongoDB database. And I basically took an ASP.NET MVC4 app and built the CRUD operations against it, against MongoDB. And I did all this last night at 10 o'clock. I hadn't actually programmed against MongoDB and .NET before. But it was pretty easy to find a couple blog posts and start using it. And I used the NuGet package to connect to it. And the beauty is, I could do all that in minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not having to manage my MongoDB instances. I'm not having to create a VM. I'm not having to patch it.
Right.
And I can use all my .NET skills in Visual Studio. And it's an exciting time for developers.
Speaking of third parties, here's a question here from Guy who is saying he wants to host websites. What about hosting emails? And I think there's two questions there. There's the hosting email, and then there's the sending email, which I think are very different things.
Yeah, so I mean, for a hosting email, we don't today with Windows Azure give you like a mailbox that you can host your own email. But what we do is we partner very closely with the Office 365 team. We actually use a lot of the same data centers. And so you can actually sign up for an Office 365 account, and that does provide email as well as SharePoint hosting that you can take advantage of kind of as a managed service.
Right.
And we use now, Office 365 uses the Azure Active Directory system that we use inside Windows Azure. And so you can actually create a single login, and you can log into both Office 365 and Windows Azure with it and use it to manage your overall infrastructure. If you want to send email, we have a partner called SendGrid. And if you go to the Windows Azure Store, you can sign up for SendGrid for free. They actually have a free tier. And then if you want to send more than 25,000 emails a month, then you can go to their next tier down. And so the beauty is, you can basically be set up and be sending emails in Azure, including mass mailings, within probably about 30 seconds of going to the store, click on SendGrid, and you're provisioned probably in about 30 seconds, and away you go.
And actually tomorrow we're going to have the SendGrid guys. Mongo Labs folks, and also New Relic right here.
Oh, awesome.
On Channel 9 Live.
Cool.
So we'll do
very
that.
Cool.
Let's see. I'm going to take a look at my Surface here. By the way, this is going to disappear. There's no way this is making it out of here without me putting it in my bag. Everyone got a Surface but me. I have to wait until Christmas time or whenever you guys... You don't have one yet either.
Yeah.
They're going to give us one soon, though, I hope. Interesting question here. This gentleman is saying, Why can't I run websites in extra small VMs? Would I want to do that? And he says, give us one extra for free.
Sure.
He says his name is Poor Guy.
Poor Guy. Yeah, so...
How much cheaper can it get?
Yeah. Well, so we actually do give you 10 free websites for free. And so, actually, instead of just giving you one, I've actually given you 10. So it's 10 times better. So basically, with our website model, we do actually give you 10 websites for free forever. It's not time-bound. It's not 90 days.
It's not like a year? Isn't it 1 year?
I think according to the legal department, I'm not allowed to say forever.
Okay.
But it's
forever
free.
If it's a year.
But no, it's more than a year. It's basically free with no time-bound. But since forever, in theory, implies infinity and like a billion years.
Until the stars burn.
The lawyers say, like, you can't say forever because that's a billion years and we can't guarantee that. You know, we'll have currency in a billion years or something.
The dollar is...
But I'm allowed to say free for no...
Okay,
no,
so it's not for a year. It's for a super long time.
It's basically forever. But but I'm not allowed to say that.
We're not allowed to say anything.
We didn't say
things.
That.
Okay. But Poor Guy can run 10 websites. I know I'm running 3 without any trouble, and I haven't paid much money.
And so, so that's available for nothing. If you want to scale it up, so the free does... It allows about 100,000 requests per month or per day. I think on the free tier. There's a shared tier then, which is actually the same price as an extra small VM, so it's about 1.2 cents per hour, which works out to be about $9 per month. That gives you more compute resources. It also allows you to use custom domains, both A records and CNAME records.
Yes.
And then there's a reserve tier, and that's where you can run in a dedicated, like small or larger instance. The reason we don't support extra small is mostly because of the shared tier. We actually think performance-wise gives you better performance than an extra small VM would.
I think it's surprising how calm you are when people ask about pricing, because I would think that, you know, we're talking about pennies and dollars here. I mean, even like Mural.ly, I think they said in the keynote they're paying like $120 a month. I mean, this is a startup, and like this is the least of their costs.
Yeah.
But I think there's always that fear that somehow I'm going to wake up and it's going to be a $1,000, $10,000 bill.
Yeah.
Question here from Ali, who's asking, if there's a payment limit, could we downgrade instead of shutting it off? Have there been any talk about elasticity? I don't want to be told my website's down, log in and make it big.
Yeah.
You know, I want to be able to understand, is there a way to automatically, or maybe me script the growth of my VM?
You're going to see us do more auto-scaling capabilities in the future on Azure. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, our goal is, you know, one of our goals kind of aspirationally, you know, we don't have a time frame we're promising this on, is... Mm-hmm. Is the ability for you to sort of set up auto rules where you can scale up. And then, if you hit a certain spending limit, you could scale down. Or, you know, more commonly, you know, there's times of the day that your site gets hit a lot, and there's times of the day it's not. So if you're in an enterprise environment, 9 to 5 is typically peak time. Weekends, late evenings, not so much. And, you know, the ability to kind of scale down your resources and scale it up is definitely something that we provide today. But you got to have to kind of write your own script code to do it. We're looking to kind of make it more automatic in the future.
That would be a really cool idea. I like that idea myself. That's cool.
Yeah.
Here's a question from Joe Mataloni, who's asking about permissions. And I think this is a really interesting one, because when people are moving from a traditional IIS and a server that I can see to the cloud, they're going to say, well, I usually have a content folder, and I put permissions on it, and I upload things into that folder. I access files in the file system. How does that work in a cloud environment?
Well, in general, in a cloud environment, we typically recommend you don't, say for like a website or a cloud service app, if it's scaled across multiple machines, we generally recommend don't write it to the actual local directory.
Right.
For websites, we do replicate it across, so that will technically work, but it's not probably the most scalable solution. Instead, kind of, we typically recommend you run it, write it to kind of our Azure storage system. Because that is designed so you can hammer it from thousands of different machines. And it also doesn't have a size limit, so you could literally put petabytes into it if you wanted to. That's generally how we'd recommend. So we have a nice storage client API, you can do it.
So if I were moving something to the cloud, if I have an existing app that's great, except users upload Excel files, I would just change that code to not save it into a folder.
If you're running the website model, it'll just work.
If it's on one website.
Even if you actually have 3 websites.
Oh, really?
That point, you know, the same location, it'll actually just work.
Oh, that's cool.
For VMs or for cloud services, it only writes to the local directory, but for the website model, it does allow you to write to the disk, and it will go ahead and do it. But in general, I'd recommend if you're going to have a high volume service or site, definitely recommend check out the storage system. The nice thing is, you know, you can basically replace a couple lines of code. It does support async, like Scott showed in the keynote this morning.
Yep.
So you can also asynchronously write it, which is awfully nice, and not block the I/O thread inside ASP.NET. As part of the storage client library, you can also control the access permissions. And so you could say, this is private just to my app. You can also optionally say, I want to mark this thing public, in which point we can give you a URL that you can hit it from anywhere and retrieve the data from it.
A couple other questions about elasticity. A gentleman's asking about caching. Like, what if his cache allocation size is exceeded? Does it just start throwing old things out of the cache?
Yeah, I mean, so basically, with our new dedicated cache, you basically set kind of a cache size you want to do. And then it kind of uses kind of a least recently used kind of eviction mechanism. Mm-hmm. And so when you write stuff to the cache, if you start filling up the cache, it'll start evicting least frequently used things. And if you want to, you could also put your own custom policies in there as well.
Okay.
And
can I see that? I mean, do I see the bucket growing? And I go, wow, I need to buy a bigger cache.
Yeah, you can go ahead, and I believe you can go ahead and add a perf counter into your cloud service so you can actually see the cache size. The other thing we just did this week is, which is new, is if you click on a cloud service, there's a configure tab at the top. And you can actually now also dynamically change the size of the cache without redeploying your app. And so you can effectively say, oh, I want to add another 100 megs to my cache, mm-hmm. Without having to add machines, but you can dynamically reconfigure it, which is a cool feature we just added. And then the other nice thing is because the cache is running inside a cloud service, you can also just increase the number of VMs the cache is running on. And so if your cache is running in your web server and you say, I want now 3 instead of 2 instances, mm-hmm. the cache will dynamically grow, and then it'll redistribute the contents across the 3 machines in the background for you, and you don't lose anything. And if you shrink it, what we'll actually do is before we do the actual shrinkage, the machine that's going to get turned off will actually migrate all of its data onto the other machines
Very cool.
before it disables.
Rock on. That's
yeah,
cool. You thought everything,
cool.
didn't you?
We tried to, yeah.
Nicely done.
Yeah.
Follow-up question from that gentleman. Wanted to know, are there any free caching features or a way to do a free tier on the caching?
Well, he was asking, is the new caching feature completely free if I choose the co-locate option? So we basically support with the caching 2 options.
Mm-hmm.
One where you're using memory on the machines you've already bought. So let's say I have a web tier, or I've got a worker machine, or let's just say a web role. If you enable the cache on it, then yeah, it's completely free. Because you're using,
you've
say,
paid for that memory.
You've already paid for that machine. We're just using some of the memory on that machine. So it's completely free, absolutely no cost. If you decide to create a dedicated cache that's running on its own role within your application, then you don't have to pay anything extra to use it, but you just pay the standard price of a worker role.
That's cool. That's very convenient.
Yeah.
I've noticed that I've got something like, I don't know, 400 or 500 megs or something for my website, and it's not being used right now. I could definitely fill that up with cache.
Yep.
Win-win for everybody.
Yep.
Question here about editing schemas, looking at data in SQL Azure. The gentleman's saying that he doesn't feel that the SQL Management Studio for SQL Azure is as rich as a local SQL server.
Well, one of the things that we do support is, well, I mean, there's, you can actually use the SQL Management Studio tool
mm-hmm.
to go against both your local SQL Server 2012 and SQL Azure.
Right.
Or SQL Databases on Azure, I think is
right.
the official name now.
Yeah.
But it's actually, you can use the exact same tool in both.
Right.
Not all features inside SQL Management Studio are supported yet with the Azure version. Some of them are very specific to database management. And so SQL databases inside Azure are kind of auto-managed. So there's log directories and backup directories and things like that. We kind of do that for you.
Okay.
But there are still some features at the database level that we don't yet support. Through SQL Management Studio, but our goal is kind of eventually to support them all.
All right. Chris is asking about the size of the SQL Server database offered in the Azure free trial.
I think in the free trial, it's a 1 gigabyte database.
That's 10 websites, and then you share 1 gigabyte of SQL storage.
Yeah. You might even get 2 databases. I can't remember if it's 1 web and 1 business.
Interesting little bit of feedback. He's saying it's not obvious from the website.
Yeah. So it should be if you click on the free trial page. It actually should, I believe, at the bottom list what it is, but I believe it's a 1 gig database. And then if you once you exit the trial, the way it works is if you have a 1 gig database and you only use up to 100 megs of it, then we actually charge you at only $4.99 a month. So you actually get a discount. And then if you use the full gig, it's $9.99 a month.
Very cool. Serge is asking about running virtual machines and custom database servers. We've got partners like Mongo Labs. What if he wants to run something like Redis?
Yeah, so the cool, so today, Serge, what you typically do if you want to run Redis is you'd need to spin up a VM and basically install Redis in it.
Either Linux or Windows version.
Linux or Windows. Generally, Redis probably works only with Linux. Well, I don't think the Windows version yet is as full featured or as reliable. But the nice thing about Azure is you can spin up, you know, an Ubuntu instance or CentOS instance, put Redis in there, and away you go. Mm-hmm. I expect we'll probably see a Redis managed offering through the Windows Azure Store in the future. So in the same way, you can just spin up MongoDB and MySQL, both of which are in the Windows Azure Store today. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll probably be able to go ahead and get a fairly inexpensive Redis account that way as well.
How can people get the word out, the people that are listening, about the features that they think are important to them? Because I know that you're making all these juggling and decisions about the backlog of things that you think are important.
Yeah.
And I know that Josh Twist was here with Paul Badiman talking about, if you have ideas for mobile services, tweet Josh Twist.
Yeah.
Are you reading all your tweets, even though you don't necessarily reply to them all?
Yeah.
If they say, hey, Scott Goo, I want this, we want this, and you feel that there's an upswelling of support for some feature X,
yep.
Do you hear that?
Yeah, I mean, I generally try to read all the tweets that people send me, and a lot of people send me email.
I know, because you forward them to me.
occasionally ask for helpers when they have a problem that I don't know the answer to.
Don't email a vice president of Microsoft because you need tech support.
Yeah.
FYI,
just
you heard it here.
Email Scott directly. I think generally, you know, events like this are a good place where we kind of get feedback on what are we missing. You know, in general, one of the things that you know, we're trying to do is be as, you know, change to a much more agile model. So in general, a lot of our feature teams now are shipping every 3 weeks, which is kind of a big change in where we historically were. Some teams are more like 4 or 6 weeks, but generally get into a model where we're continuously shipping and get a very agile approach where, you know, we can basically keep a backlog, and as we see things move up and down, we pull them off the backlog and implement them. And that's kind of allowed us over the last couple of months to kind of do a lot of things fast, and you'll hopefully see that cadence. Part of the agile approach that we're also trying to do is be very data-driven. And so, you know, emails and tweets are one source of data. We've also instrumented the service in a pretty deep way. And so, you know, I can actually sit in my office and pull up reports on literally what are people doing in Azure. I can't see individual names, so it's anonymized, so we can't actually see your code or anything. But, you know, like for Josh's service, the mobile services, you know, we can see, like, how many people are using server-side scripts.
Right.
What's the average size of the script? You know, are they doing inserts and reads, or are they just doing deletes and other things? You know, how many people are enabling notifications? And we use that to kind of basically understand how is the product being built. And if we see one area where people are using it over and over and over again, we invest more there. If we see an area and we're like, well, that feature didn't turn out to be quite as popular as we thought,
right.
You know, we can see that literally in real time on an hourly basis. And it's kind of a fun way to build the product because you actually are really knowing how people are using it,
mm-hmm.
And you can kind of optimize the experience in a nice way.
So we've only got 4 more minutes left. We've got a couple questions we want to bang through here. We've already talked a little bit, like Ian Clark's question here about scheduling capacity, that you are looking at that and the idea of having kind of auto scale and elasticity. But there's another question here from Mark in a similar role about changing the role types in management versus a development environment. Do you have the ability to switch back and forth from the PowerShell commandlets? Can you do this from the command line? Can I do it from Visual Studio? Let me ask you this. Where are all the different ways that you're allowing people to manage Azure? Like, we just announced the ability to go look at our queues and our blobs and our tables in Visual Studio, but you don't want to bring the entire portal into Visual Studio necessarily. But you've also got the ability to do things from the command line and in PowerShell. What kinds of tasks are appropriate for these different venues?
From an architecture perspective, we basically have a management API that's a REST-based management API at the base level.
Mm.
And so pretty much everything that you do from a management perspective goes through there. So you can always write down at the lowest level and just send us HTTP calls.
And that's okay?
Yeah, we support that and we document it.
So I can totally, if I don't like our PowerShell, I don't like our Visual Studio, I want to do everything with Bash scripts.
Yep.
And I'm going to script all of Azure. I can do it with those RESTful APIs.
Yeah, yep. And our portal, our nice portal experience, is built on top of that. And so kind of one kind of general principle we have is to make sure that our portal never does a backdoor. It always goes through the public REST endpoints for doing management. Nice. And that basically helps ensure that anything we provide a GUI on top of, you can also script and automate at a lower layer. And then we basically have PowerShell as well as command line tools that are cross-plat with Node.js, both of which we've open sourced and put into GitHub. So you can also look at the source if you want to modify.
You can see how it's making the calls itself.
Exactly, yeah. So those are kind of the different ways we do it. You know, in terms of asking about auto-scaling, we do have a project we call the Wasabi Project. And it's kind of more of a sample of prescriptive guidance. It comes from the Patterns and Practices team. And that does demonstrate how you can use monitoring data to auto-scale your app up and down.
Oh, wow.
Okay. So that is a cool thing to check out if you're looking to kind of do that auto-scaling capability. As I mentioned earlier in the talk, you know, we are looking to kind of add that auto-scale capability directly in the platform in the future. What we're also, the question there was, can you go ahead and change the role size? With cloud services, we allow you to basically increase or decrease the size of the role, or the numbers of instances of the roles. Mm-hmm. I don't think today we allow you to change the role size dynamically, going from like a small to a medium. Mm-hmm. What you can do, though, is you can basically stage a new version of your app with the different role size configurations. And then we do support the ability of what's called to do a VIP swap, where basically you could reconfigure your app, you could add roles, delete roles, change the size, do whatever you want.
Right.
Get it going, get it deployed in a staging environment. You just push a button in the portal, and all the traffic will go to the new version, and the old version will drain off.
So you make a big one, you drain off of a small one, and now you've effectively sized it up yourself.
Yeah. And then when you can either swap back if you discover there's a problem, or you could delete the old one. So it is possible to change the role size, but I believe today you have to go through a VIP swap in order to do it.
Very cool. Well, thanks so much
for
coming here.
All that can be automated.
Thanks for spending time with us and having us ask you questions.
My pleasure.
All right. This is Channel 9 Live, and we're having all sorts of fun here. Make sure that you're telling all your friends about ch9.ms. And this has been Scott Gu, and we'll see you again after the break.
Thanks a bunch.